Flashman and the Redskins by George MacDonald Fraser. Continued. Cassette 5, Side 1.
I must procure a couple of mounts for the journey, which could be done in the morning, and assemble what packages we needed. I had enough ready money for that, and she had almost $100 of her own, typique, from satisfied customers in Orléans and here in Santa Fe. So we should be all right to begin with. I must conceal our packages in the summerhouse, and tomorrow night, when the frenzy was at its customary height, we'd foregather at midnight by the back gate and be off. There was no reason, really, why we shouldn't have bowled off publicly. But the less pover, the better. I'm always ready, as a rule, to turn the knife in anyone's wound, but I had a soft spot for Susie, and recollections of the brisk way she'd corrected John Charity Springs' exercises for him. I'd no wish to have the porters setting about me on behalf of a woman scorned. Arab gelding for myself and a mule for Clarny. Left them in a livery stable with the final arrangements. By late afternoon, I had our packages stowed in the summer house, along with my rifle and six-shooter. Then, for old time's sake, I surprised Susie at her toilet, and let her work her evil will of me, as we'd used to in Orleans. She blubbered even afterwards, and my last memory is of her sitting there in her corset, sighing heavily and exclaiming at her reflection, with a glass of port beside her, "I'll have a drink in the cider cellars for you," thinks I, and closed the door. It was a slow night in the gaming room, but all hands to the pumps in the bedrooms by the sound of it. At a few minutes to 12, I got up and sauntered through the grounds to the summer house. And for some reason my heart was beating 50 to the dozen. I got my hat and slipped my revolver into its holster. There was a rustle through the pines and the patter of feet, and Cleone was beside me, a cloak over her head, held at her throat, her eyes shining in that lovely face, pale in the darkness. She threw her arms round me, fairly sobbing with excitement, and I kissed her with some ardour and gave them a loving squeeze. Goodness, it was all there, though, and as I'd done at every assignation with her, I shivered in anticipation. From the distant house came the strains of music and the faint sound of laughter. I cautioned her to wait and slipped out through the back gate to see that all was clear. It was an alley leading at one end to a street which ran to the plaza. Up there were lights and folk and traffic passing by, but down here all was in dark shadow. Something rustled on the wall behind me, and I whirled and froze in my track, my hand fumbling for the butt of my pistol, but checked by sheer terror as a figure moved out from the wall, lean and lithe as a cat, and I gasped as the light fell on the tight-stretched skin of a painted face, with eyes like coals, and above, the double feathers of a Navajo Indian. Before I could move, there were two others, twin spectres on either side of me, naked to the waist. But I hadn't had time even to think of screaming when a voice whispered behind me, and I turned with a sob of relief to see the little priest. He held out a leather satchel to me.
$2,000 as agreed. Where is she?
I was so stricken I could only nod at the gate, and then I found my voice. Indians, for Christ's sake!
Did you not say this afternoon that men would be needed to carry her off in silence?
He gestured to the Navajos, and they slipped silently through the gate. There was a muffled gasp and a small clatter, as though a chair had been disturbed, and then they were in the alley again, one of them carrying Cleone's squirming figure over his shoulder, while a second brave held her ankles, and the leader kept a heavy blanket close wrapped round her head. He grunted at the priest, and the three melted noiselessly into the dark, while I held the wall and babbled at the priest. "My God, those brutes gave me a turn! I thought you'd bring your own people!"
"I told you today, since you insisted, that my patron was Jose Cujillo Blanco, Jose White Knife. What more natural than that he should send his own bravos to take her? Why, does the sight of them alarm you on her behalf? Let me point out that you have had several hours to reflect on it, and on her fate as the wife of a Navajo chief."
"I wasn't expecting those painted horrors to be lurking in the dark, that's all," says I, pretty warm. "Look here, though, will he really marry her, do you think?"
"After their fashion, does it matter? For $2,000, perhaps you should count them.
Oh, and the receipt, if you please." So help me, the little bastard had a document and a pencil.
In case the sale should ever be questioned, it is improbable. The wife of White Knife is not likely to be seen in Santa Fe again, or indeed anywhere.
I scribbled a signature. B.M. Coma R.N. Retired.
Well now, Padre, I hope he takes decent care of her, that's all. I mean, it's only because you're a man of the cloth that...
Tell me, says I, for I was agog with curiosity. I didn't care to ask earlier, but ain't it a trifle out of the way for a priest to be procuring women for savages?
He folded the receipt. We have many missions in the Del Norte Valley, many villages whose people look to us for help. Cuchillo Blanco knows this. How should he not? He whose bands have left red bloody ruin in the settlements these years past. He comes to Santa Fe. He hears of the beautiful white women whose bodies are for sale. He desires white women.
Now, I told you, she ain't white, strictly speaking. Part frog, part nigger.
She will be white to him. However, he fears that there will be reluctance to sell to an Indian, so he sends word to us, buy me such a woman, and the missions and settlements will be spared for a season. Shall I hesitate to buy him a woman who gives herself to anyone for hire, when by doing so I can save the lives, perhaps the souls, of scores of men, women, and children? If it is a sin, I shall answer to God for it.
I saw his eyes glitter in the dark.
And you, senor, with your $2,000, how will you answer to God for these? What souls will you tell him that you have saved?
You never know, padre, says I. Maybe she'll convert your Navajo chief to Christianity. I picked up my gear from the summer house when he'd gone and went quickly down through the crowded plaza to the livery stable, where I slung my few traps over the mule, stowed the heavy purse of eagles in my money belt, and rode out on the Albuquerque trail. I won't say I didn't regret Clarence's absence. Clever lass, fine mount, charming conversationalist, but too saucy by half, and she'd never have earned us $2,000 between Santa Fe and El Paso. Not in the month of Sundays. From Santa Fe to Algodones on the river, the trail was dotted that night with emigrant campfires, and I passed their clusters of wagons as I rode, first through cultivated land, and then through scrubby mesa. The Del Norte was smaller than I expected. You think of the Rio Grande as something huge to compare with the Mississippi, which it may be farther down for all I know. This wasn't much larger than the Thames, muddy brown and flowing between banks of cottonwood, with ugly black crags looming up away on the southern horizon. I pushed on through the next night to Albuquerque, a big village swollen by the caravans and by the huts of the Mexican and American miners who worked the nearby goldfield. Here I sold the mule and considered crossing to the west bank. There were wagons and tents clustered all round the ford, and crowds of people making tremendous work of floating their vehicles and goods across on rafts and flatboats. The river hereabouts was quite swift, and about a quarter of a mile across, through sandbars and quicksands. I watched one schooner being poled precariously across the currents, and then the whole thing pitched slowly into the river, while fellows roared and struggled in the water and hauled on lines and got in each other's way, and all was confusion. The west bank seemed no better than the east, anyway, so I held on south along the wagon road, where there was plenty of traffic in both directions. That was when I discovered a new pleasure in life, riding in the American West. I'd spent enough time in the saddle on the plains, you might think, but this was different. Here I was alone and could take my own time. In other parts of the world, one always seems to be in a great hurry, tearing from one spot to the other at a gallop. But out yonder, perhaps because distances are so great, time don't seem to matter. You can jog along, breathing fresh air, and enjoying the scenery and your own thoughts about women and home and hunting and booze and money, and what may lie over the next hill. It's easy and pleasant and first-rate in every way, and at night you can build your own fire and roll up in a blanket, Or join some other fellas who are sure to make you welcome, and share a meal with you and a yarn over coffee, or something sensible from a flask. This is in settled country, you understand. The Del Norte seem to be settled enough, for all Harrison's alarming talk, and if it ain't the finest scenery in the continent, it was new to me. It's not a valley, as we in England know the word. The river runs through its cottonwood fringe past numerous Mexican villages full of stray dogs and loafers in sombreros. All of them either asleep or preparing to lie down. Someone must work the place, though, for there are plenty of cultivated fields beyond the cottonwoods, with here and there a rancheria or a hacienda, some of them quite fine, and beyond them again the scrubby plain stretching away on either side, with a dark barrier of mountains to the east, and little else to take the eye except one great black wedge of rock to the left, which I had in view all through one day's ride. Not Buckinghamshire, but it'll do. Any landscape without Indians suited me just then. 6 days down from Santa Fe, I came to the ford at Socorro, where there was a fair concourse of emigrants. A few miles farther down, the Del Norte makes a great belly to the west, and it seemed to me from the map that time could be saved by making due south away from the river, and behind the Cristobal Mountains to rejoin it at Doña Ana. I mentioned this to a dragoon dispatch rider with whom I breakfasted at Socorro, and he shook hands solemnly and said, "Should he write to my family?" "You take that road if you've a mind to," says he facetiously. "It's got this to be said for it, it's nice and flat. Other than that, I'd think hard before I'd recommend it. Of course, maybe you like the notion of 125 miles of rock and sand and dust and dead bones. Plenty of them along the old wagon trail. No water, though, unless you happen to find a rain pool of the laguna or a point of rocks. Which you won't this time of year. But you won't mind, because the Apaches will have skinned you by then anyway. Or rather, they won't, because before that you'll have died of thirst. That," says this wag, "is why it's called the Jornada del Muerto, the dead man's journey. There's only one way across it, and that's to fill your mount with water till he leaks, take at least 2 canteens, start at 3 in the morning and go like hell. Because if you don't make it in under 24 hours, you don't make it. Staying with the river, are you? That's your sort, old fella. Good day to you." So I crossed the river like most of the emigrants and kept to the trail along its west bank. Some of them struck out due west, God knows where to. There was less traffic now, and by the time I came to Fra Cristobal, I was riding more or less alone. I passed the occasional hamlet and small party of emigrants, but by afternoon of the second day after leaving Socorro, it was becoming damned bleak. I pushed on, with a great sinister black rock looming across the river to my left, scrubby bushes and hills to the right, and devil a sign of life ahead. For the first time since Santa Fe, I began to feel a chill down my spine. The priest's tales of savage bands who roamed this country filled my mind with visions of ravaged villages and burned-out wagons. I began to fancy hidden watchers among the rocks and bushes, and whenever a fragment of tumbleweed rolled across my path, I had the vapors. Far off, a prairie dog yowled, and the wind made a ghostly rustle through the cottonwoods. Dusk came down, my spirit sank with it, and then it was dark, and the chill of the night air sank into my bones. There was nothing for it but to stop where I was, curl up under a bush, and wait for morning. Not for the life of me was I going to light a fire in that desolation. And on the heels of the thought, I caught a glimpse, far off through the gloom, of what might have been a spark of light. I gulped, and slowly went on, leading my horse. The chances were that it was emigrants or hunters. Then again, perhaps not. It was a light, sure enough, a campfire, and a big one. I stood irresolute, and then, from the dark ahead, a voice made me leap 3 feet. "Hola, ¿qué quiere usted? ¿Quién es usted?" I fairly shuddered with relief. "Amigo, no tiras, soy forastero." A shape loomed up a few yards ahead, and I saw it was a Mexican in a poncho, rifle at the ready. "Venga," says he, so I came forward and he fell in behind, as I led my horse into a clearing under the cottonwoods, where the great fire blazed, with what looked like an antelope roasting over it. There were groups of men seated around smaller fires, some of whom glanced in my direction, buckskin hunters, Mexicans, two or three Indians in shirts, but mostly rough traders or hunters, so far as I could see. Close by the main fire stood a group of three, headed by a burly fellow with feathers in his hat and two pistols belted over his frock coat. When he turned, I saw he had a forked beard and a great red birthmark over half his face. A Sunday school teacher, devil a doubt. "Who are you?" grunts he in English, and for some reason or other I replied, "Flashman, I'm an Englishman, going to El Paso." The cold eyes surveyed me indifferently. "You're late on the road. There's mole in the pan there, unless you want to wait for the buck." And he turned back to the fire, ignoring my thanks. I hitched my horse with the others, got out my Dixie, and was helping myself to stew and tortillas when one of his companions, a tall Mexican and a serape, says,
"You go alone to El Paso. He's not safe, amigo. There are mescaleros in the Jornada and Jicarilla bands between here and Doña Ana."
"Which way are you going yourselves, then?" says I. And the Mex hesitated and shrugged. Forkbeard turned for another look at me.
"Chihuahua," says he. "In a week, maybe. Doing us some hunting in the Gili Forest. You want to ride with us?"
He paused and then added,
"My name's Gallantin, John Gallantin."
It meant nothing to me, but I had a notion it was supposed to. They were watching me warily, and I had to remind myself that in this country men seldom took each other on easy trust. They were a rough crew, but that in itself was not out of the way. They seemed friendly disposed, and if there were Apaches on the loose, as the Mexican said, I'd be a sight safer along with this well-heeled party, even if it took a few days longer. The Mexican laughed and winked at me.
"Safer to arrive, how you say, than not get there."
That wink gave me a momentary qualm for the cargo of dollars in my money belt, but I was in no case to refuse. "Much obliged to you, Mr. Gallantin. I'll ride along with you." He nodded and asked had I plenty of charges for my revolver and Colt rifle. Well, after I sat down by one of the smaller fires and gave my attention to the grub, taking stock of the company as I ate. No, they were more like hunters than bandits, at that. Some sober citizens among them, mostly American, although as much Spanish as English was being spoken. But it was English with a nice soft brogue that broke in upon my thoughts.
"I'd have sworn the last time I saw you the name was Comer. Flashman, is it? And where have I heard that before now?"
says Grattan Nugent Hare. Chapter 10. Since I have a mouthful, it wouldn't have done to speak, but for a moment I had difficulty swallowing. There he stood, large as life, pulling at his nose, and then he snapped his fingers.
11th Hussars, that duel at Canterbury, was it? And then Afghanistan 7 to 8 years back. You're that, Flashman?"
My indiscretion could hardly matter down here, so I admitted it, and he gave that slow, foxy grin, but with a harder eye than I remembered. There was nothing lazy about the set of him, either.
"Well, well, wonders never cease. Didn't I know you were cavalry? Travelling in cog, too. And what might you be doing down this way so far from Santa Fe? Not looking for me, I hope."
Until that moment, I'd absolutely forgotten that this rascal had 2,000 of my... well, of Susie's dollars in his poke. Plainly, this called for tact. "Far from it," says I. "Have you spent it yet?" He took a sharp breath and his hand moved on his belt.
"Let's say it's cashed in a safe place," says he softly, "and there it'll stay. But you haven't answered me question. What's your purpose here? Don't tell me you've left that old strumpet."
"What's it to you if I have?
Faith, you might have given me warning and I'd have stayed on, so I would."
The grin was decidedly unpleasant now.
"She'd be needing a man about the place."
I chewed and looked him up and down, but said nothing, which stung as it was meant to. He gave a bark of a laugh.
"Aye, look how you like,"
says he. "It's not that kind of look she'd been giving me at all, or did, while her rogered her fat bottom off all the way from the Council Grove. Didn't guess that, did you? While you were taking the tail of every black wench in sight, more shame to you." He sat down beside me, well pleased with what he supposed was his bombshell. "Fair mortified at your infidelity, so she was, and her such a fine, hearty woman. Ah, well, she paid you back by making a cuckold of you." I'd never liked or trusted friend Grattan above half, even when he was being civil. Now I found him downright detestable. Not, oddly enough, because he'd kept Susie warm, for I didn't doubt his story, and it didn't diminish my affection for her a bit. The Randy Trot paying me back in my own coin. And why not? She'd always known well enough that I was like the Toby man who couldn't be satisfied by one woman, any more than a miser could by one guinea, and that I'd stray sooner rather than later. She was another of the same herself, and it was gratifying to realize that she'd been prepared to keep me on, knowing I was unfaithful, and never say a word. Quite a compliment. Dear Susie. No, my dislike of Grattan was for his own sweet sake, nothing else.
"You don't seem to mind," says he.
"Why should I? She's a lustful bitch and has to have somebody. I dare say she preferred you to one of the teamsters. Not much, though, or she'd have given you for the asking what you had to steal in the end. I think," says I, rising, "I'll have some coffee." He was on his feet when I came back, but the foxy grin was absent, and the voice less soft than usual.
"I don't care for the word steal, you know, especially from a man that's ashamed to use his own name."
"Then stay out of his way," says I, sipping. "He can stand it."
"Can he so? Well, then he'd better stay out of mine," says he nastily. "And if he has any clever ideas about a certain sum of money, he'd best forget him, do you see? I've seen you in action, me Afghan hero, and I'm not a bit impressed."
He tapped his colt butt. I weighed him up. "Tell me, Grattan," says I, "did Susie ever cry over you?"
"What's that? Why the devil should she?"
asks he suspiciously. "Why, indeed," says I, and ignored him, and after a moment he swaggered off, but continued to keep an eye on me. He couldn't believe my arrival had nothing to do with his theft, and certainly it was an odd chance that had brought us together again. No doubt he, too, was on the run for Mexico. I'd have set his doubts at rest if he'd been less offensive about Susie, but he'd proved himself a cheap creature without style. Cheney Tenth? What would you? I kept my eye on him, too, and when we bedded down, I changed my place after an hour, and in the morning saw that Sir D. We were away before dawn, and I saw that the group was about 40 strong, and well able to look after itself, riding two and two with point and flank scouts. In the afternoon, Gallantin sent two Indians ahead to find a campsite. They came back at the gallop and conferred with Gallantin and the tall Mexican, constantly pointing ahead. I was too far back to hear. But the way the word PASH rippled down the column, and men began to look to their priming and tighten their girths, said all that was necessary. We went on at the canter until we smelled smoke, and then, in a big clearing among the woods, we came on a burning hacienda. A splendid place it must have been, but now a blackened ruin with the flames still licking on its charred walls, and a dense pall of smoke overhead. There were bodies huddled about the place, and a few slaughtered beasts. But no one gave them even a look. The party scattered on Gallantin's orders, hunting among the outbuildings and stables, and the Indians circled about the limits, their eyes on the ground. Presently there were shouts, and I went with three or four others to where a couple of our buckskin men were kneeling beside a trough, supporting the body of a small, white-haired woman. They'd found her crouched under a blanket in an outhouse, but even when they'd given her water, she could only gaze about in a stupefied way. And then she began to sing in an awful cracked voice, and laughed crazily. So they laid her down on the blanket and resumed their search. I went with the tall Mexican, and found more than I wanted to. Behind the hacienda, rather smaller houses, all of them smouldering wrecks, and among them more bodies, scalped and mutilated. They were all peons, so far as I could bear to look at them, with flies buzzing thick about them. The Mexican stooped over one.
"Dead less than an hour," says he. A few minutes earlier, by the guts of God, and we would have had them.
He grimaced.
See there.
I looked and stood horrified. Only a few yards away, by a high adobe wall, was a row of trees, and from their branches hung at least a dozen bodies, naked, and so hideously mutilated that your first thought was of carcasses slung in a butcher's shop, streaked with blood. They were all hung by the heels, about a foot above the ground, and beneath each one a fire was still smouldering directly under their heads, if you can call them heads after they've burst open. They stay long enough for fun, anyway, says one of the buckskin men and spat. Then he turned away with a shrug and said something to his partner, and they both laughed. That was the most horrible thing of all, not the hanging bodies or the scalped corpses or the vile stench, but the fact that none of Gallantin's followers paid the slightest heed. No one bothered with a body, except the Mexican when he pronounced on the dead peon. For the rest, they just hunted among the ruins, and whatever they were bent on, it had nothing to do with the 20 or more poor devils who'd been murdered and tortured in that ghastly shambles. I've served with some hard cases, but never with any who didn't betray horror or disgust or pity, or at least interest, at such beastly sights. But not this bunch of ruffians. Then there was a yell from the other side of the hacienda, and everyone gathered where Gallantin and the Indians were examining a ball of horse dung in the dust. There was a great buzz of talk as an Indian and a bearded trapper poked and sniffed, and then the trapper cries, "Grandma!" and held up a peck of ordure for inspection. I didn't know then that these Indians and frontiersmen could tell from the age and composition of droppings just where a horse has come from, and who owns it, and what his grandfather had for luncheon 2 weeks ago, damn near. Maize seeds and the crap mean Mexicans, and barley Americans, in case you're interested. Another Indian was crawling about examining the ground, and presently comes up to Gallantin and says,
"Mimbreno."
"Copper mines banned for sure," says Gallantin. "How many?" The Indian opened and closed his hands 9 times rapidly.
90 ponies, eh? Maybe 2 hours off by now, but I doubt it. Heading west. Hey, Hilario, that smoke t'other day could be a camp, huh? 90 ponies could be a couple of 100 pesh.
That's $40,000-$50,000, says someone. And there were yells and laughs and cries of, "Hurrah, boys!" while they brandished their pieces and slapped each other on the back.
"Hey, Jack, that's better than beaver, I reckon."
"Better than a plug, a plow, a black fox, you mean?"
"That's your style. Mimbreno hair is the prime crop this year."
"I'm not hearing right," thinks I, "or else they're crazy." I couldn't make out why they were suddenly in such spirits. What was there in this ghastly place to be satisfied about, let alone delighted? I wasn't alone, as it turned out. Hilario, the tall Mexican, roared to us all to saddle up. And when we came back to the group about Gallantin, all became suddenly and shockingly clear. 2 fellows, one a plain bearded emigrant sort, whom I'd noted as a sober file the previous night, and the other a youngster of about 20, were in hot argument with Gallantin. I came in towards the finish, when the sober chap was shaking his fist and crying, "No, damned if he would, so there." Gallantin, hunched in his saddle, glared at him in fury and flung out a hand to point at the burned-out hacienda. "Don't you give a damn about that, then? You don't care that them red snakes butcher and burn our folks? You one of these bastard engine lovers, seem like? Hey, boys, here's the fella sweet on the bashes." There was a growl from the assembled riders, but the sober card shouted above it, "I give a damn too, but I ain't no scalp hunter. There's a law for them red sticks, and I reckon the army can deal with them." This was drowned in a roar of derision. Gallantin's eye rolled with rage, and he fairly spat his reply. "The army, by Christ! A sight of good the army done this place. You ain't no scalp hunter, says you. Then what the hell you joined with us for?"
"We didn't know what you was," cries the youth. "You think we was some old lady's knitting party by the holy? Come on, Leif,"
says the sober card in disgust.
"Let 'em get their blood money if they wants."
He He swung into his saddle and the young fellow followed suit.
"Scalp hunters,"
growls the other and swung his mount away.
"Where the hell you think you going?"
bawls Gallant in a huge fury.
"Away from you,"
snaps the youth, and followed his partner.
"Come back here. You ain't going to put the soldiers after us, by God."
And he would have spurred after them, I believe, but Hilario snapped his fingers at one of the Indians, and quicker than light the brute whipped out his hatchet and flung it after the departing pair. It hit the youth square in the back with a sickening smack. He screamed and pitched from the saddle with that awful thing buried in his spine. And as his partner wheeled, Hilario shot him twice. The sober chap rolled slowly past his horse's head and fell beside the other. His horse whinnied and bolted. Hilario spun the smoking pistol in his hand, and Gallantin cursed horribly at the two fallen men. The youth was flopping about with awful gasps. Then he was still. No one moved.
"They'd have put the soldiers on us," says Gallantin. "Well, there they be. Any other child of their mind?"
I knew one who was. Not to notice, though, and if any others shared my doubts, they kept quiet about it. It had happened with such fell speed, and now it was done, there was only stony indifference on the bearded, savage faces of the band. Not all were indifferent, though. The Indian retrieved his hatchet and called an inquiry to Hilario, who nodded. The Indian drew his knife, stooped over the youth, grunted with disgust, and stepped instead to the corpse of the older man. He knelt, seized the hair, made one swift circle with his point, and dragged off the scalp with brutal force. He stuffed the awful bloody thing into his belt, and then one of the hunters, a huge pockmarked ruffian, slipped from his saddle.
"This coon don't see $300 going to waste," cries he.
And no one said a word while he scalped the dead youth.
"Reckon it's good as Mambrino here, boys?"
He grinned round, bloody knife in one hand and dripping scalp in the other.
"Good as squaws here, maybe,"
cries another.
"Kind of fine, Bill."
A few of the others laughed, and I noticed Grattan was wearing that foxy half-grin as he sat and tugged at his long nose. Myself, I reflected that here was another good anecdote for the next church social, and studied to look unconcerned. What else was there to do? For, like it or not, I was fairly stuck, and while I had much food for thought as we headed westward into the evening sun, there could be only one conclusion. Here I was, by the most awful freak of chance, among a band of those scalp hunters of whom young Harrison had spoken, but whom I'd suppose no longer existed now that American law governed the land. It was flattery of a kind, I suppose, that Gallantin had looked me over and thought me worth recruiting. I recalled our brief conversation of last night and the way he'd spoken his name. He wasn't to know that he was addressing perhaps the one man in New Mexico to whom it meant nothing. I'd ride along with him, I'd said in my innocence, and there was nothing else for it. Even without the fearful example of those two scalp deserters, I'd never have dared to quit in a countryside alive, apparently, with the kind of fiends who had wrought the destruction of the hacienda. It was an irony that I was too terrified to appreciate that my one hope lay in the company of these foul brutes who were carrying me mile by mile closer to battle, murder, and sudden death, which I could only hope would not be mine. We rode the sun down and pushed on into steep country of hills covered with pine and cedar, with only the briefest of halts, while Gallantin and Hilario conversed with our Indians. Mile after mile we went through that fragrant maze, and the order came back to eat from our saddlebags as we rode, for Gallantin had the scent and knew exactly where he wanted to go. God knows how many miles it was, or how he and the others were so sure of the way. I can night foray as well as most by the stars, but in those dense bottoms and ravines, or along those precipitous hillsides, thick with trees, I lost all sense of direction. But I know we rode 14 hours from the hacienda, and I was beginning to believe my Arab must founder under me, when a halt was called. But even then it was only to take to the woods on foot, groping through the night with your hand at one man's belt, while another held you behind,
trying for dear life not to thrash about like a mad bear in a canebrake, gripping your rifle and gritting your teeth against the pain of saddle sore buttocks. I became aware that the sky was getting lighter, and Ilario, who led my line, urged us on with whispers. Once he stopped and pointed, and over the bushy ridge ahead was a dim reddish glow that was not of the dawn. Oh, Jesus, thinks I, now for it. As we pressed forward slowly up the slope, testing each step before we took it, no longer in touch, but each for himself with Ilario ahead. Then it was down on our bellies and crawl. The dark was thin enough to see the man either side, and Ilario in front, as he motioned us forward. We reached the summit of the ridge and lay screened among the bushes, drenched in sweat and like to drop. But in no danger, I assure you, of dozing off. To explain, as I understood the thing later, Galantine had identified the marauders as Mimbreno Apaches of the Santa Rita copper mines, which lay some distance to the south. He had suspected the presence of a camp of them in this fastness of the Gila forest, a sort of temporary base to which this particular band had moved, no doubt for game. Apaches, you must know, are almost entirely nomadic, and will move on after a week or a few months, as they feel inclined. They build no permanent houses. Their home, as they say, is their fireplace. Galantine had further calculated that after their successful attack on the hacienda, they would return to camp, there to whoop it up in celebration and gorge and booze on tizwine and cactus juice, and keep the girls in stitches with accounts of how their flayed victims had wriggled over the fires. By dawn, he reckoned they would be well under, and here it was dawn, the rays striking down through the trees into the little valley, and on the heights about Galantine and co. were ready to go into business. I wondered if Lieutenant Harrison knew that the going rate for Apache hair was now $300 a pelt. Better than beaver, indeed. Beneath us was a rocky, narrow defile, with a brook running through it, broadening into a goodish stream at a point where the defile itself opened out briefly into a level space of about an acre, before it closed again to a rocky gorge. On the level space was the Indian village, and behind it rocks rose almost sheer for 70 feet to a forested lip. On our side the slope down was steep and studded with bushes. The ends of the defile were thick wooded clefts. A splendid lurking place, in fact, provided it was never found. Galantine had found it, and so it had become a death trap. If the Apaches had posted sentries, I suppose they'd been dealt with, but I doubt if they had. Flown with triumph, confident of their remote security, they wouldn't see the need. I half expected that we would rush the place at dawn, and wasn't relishing a melee in the valley bottom. And indeed that is what would have happened if the village had been in an open place with avenues of escape. What I had overlooked was that this wasn't a military or punitive expedition, it was hunting. The one aim was to kill the quarry and take its pelt at 60 quid the time. If your game can scatter, you must pounce and take it by surprise. When it's fish in a barrel, your best road is to sit safe on the edge and destroy it at leisure. I tried to explain this once in an article to The Field entitled The Human Quarrier's Big Game and the Case for and Against Preserving, in which I laboured the point that to scalp hunters the Apaches were no different from bear or wolf or antelope. Of course they hated the brutes, but they ain't too sweet on wolf or lion either, and a hunter's hate tends to be in proportion to his fear of the quarry. Oh, there were some to whom the lust of slaughter was sweeter than the scalp price. Folk who'd had families murdered and tortured and enslaved by these savages. Or those, like myself that day, who perfectly enjoyed paying back what had been done at the hacienda. But for most it was a matter of business and profit. I cited the case I've described to you in which the hunters scalped two of their own kind, and pointed out that there were those in New Mexico at that time who claimed that Galantine's practice of selling any hair he could get, Mexican, American, friendly Indian and the like, was ethically unsound. It gave scalp hunting a bad name, they said. The Field didn't print my piece. Limited interest, you may say, but I hold that it's a matter worth serious discussion and would have provoked a fine correspondence.
So we waited, as the light grew until we could easily see the sprawl of wiki-ups on the level ground beyond the stream. They're big skin igloos with willow frames, perhaps 20 feet across, and can hold a family with ease, with a hole on top to let out smoke and stink. The whole place was filthy with refuse, and a few curs were prowling among it. Here and there a human being was to be seen, a couple of braves sprawled and presumably drunk in the open, an old woman kindling a fire, a boy playing at the stream. Down near the gorge end was a rough corral in which were about 100 ponies. Ilario passed whispered word of the range, 120 yards. I looked to my caps, eased out my pistol, and examined my revolving rifle, head well down in the rough grass of the crest. There were about 15 of us spread along it, 5 yards apart. The remainder of our band were evenly divided among the trees at either end of the defile. Nothing could get in or out. Nothing did. The place began to stir, and I got my first look at the famous Apaches, the Shishinde Men of the Woods, or as they're widely and simply known, the enemy. I'd had an impression that they were small, but not so. These, being Mimbreno of the copper mines, were not among the largest. Even so, they were sturdy, well-made brutes, ugly as sin and lithe and easy in their movements. Their hair was long and undressed, and while some wore it bound in a scarf, most were bare-headed except for a brow circlet. A few were in shirts and leggings. Many wore only the breech clout. The women, in tunics, were buxom peasants. No tall, willowy jungle princesses here. Their voices, shrill and sharp, floated across the stream as they fetched water, or busied themselves at the fires, with the kidneys and kedgeree, no doubt. A few braves sauntered down to the corral, others sat outside the wiki-ups to yawn and gossip, and one or two began to paint, an operation which seemed to call for much care and criticism from bystanders. There must have been more than 150 in view when one fellow in fringed leggings and a blanket stood forth and told the others to fall in, at which most of the men drifted in his direction to listen. The hunter next to me snapped his fingers softly and nodded, cocking his piece. I passed the signal on and lay with my heart thumping. At a whispered word, I pushed the rifle cautiously forward, covering a stout savage on the edge of the main group, my foresight just above his rump. I won't pretend I had a vision of those bodies at the hacienda, or any nonsense of that sort. He was a target, and any soldier from the saintly Gordon downwards would tell you the same. Crack! The shot came from the gorge, and the whole rim of the valley exploded in fire and smoke. I squeezed off and saw my savage leap and topple sideways. Around him they were falling, and the whole camp boiled with dust and re-echoed with screams and the boom of shots as we poured our fire into them point blank.